Welcome to Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. On the way this hour, we'll look back to a bloody era in southern Illinois when violent gangsters made big money during Prohibition. It led to vigilantism and a rise of the KKK. Governor J.B. Pritzker has had to make some tough decisions this year. That's left him open to criticism. But some of the comments made about him may have crossed a line, according to this newspaper columnist.
It's okay to disagree on policy issues, but why bring somebody's appearance or weight or anything else into the mix?
We'll talk about the weighty issue of political criticism. For those who look forward to competing in the Special Olympics, 2020 has been a disappointment. We'll hear how one athlete is coping. That and more this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up this hour, using the barber shop to reach out to black men about mental health. We'll learn about a project that's underway. We'll hear how the pandemic has impacted the Special Olympics and those who participate. And we'll talk about a time when bootlegging led to a rise in violent crime and a bloody era in southern Illinois. That and more this hour on Statewide. Well, there's no doubt there is room for improvement when it comes to civility, especially surrounding politics. One only needs to look to social media to see how nasty things have become. And just one example, criticism of Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker. A lot of people dislike his policies, and they have every right to speak about them. But then there are those comments that attack things like appearance, the governor's weight, for example. Scott Reeder took exception to that. He's a former Statehouse reporter and now a freelance journalist, and he wrote a column about what he felt was unfair criticism of the governor. He joins me now, and Scott, it's good to talk with you once again.
Great to be here.
So, Scott, why did you write this column and explain what it's all about?
Well, you know, it's just one of those things I don't quite understand. We would never criticize somebody for their religion. We'd never criticize somebody for their race. But for whatever reason, someone's weight seems to be free game and gets bandied around and talked about all the time. And there's things I agree with the governor on. There's things I don't agree with the governor on. But how much he weighs really doesn't have anything to do with how good a governor he is.
And a lot of this, of course, I think the vitriol we've heard is tied to policies, especially these COVID policies that people may be unhappy about, closing down some businesses or restricting where people can go. And you're not saying that's off limits to criticize his policies.
Not at all. Not at all.
You know, I've heard Democrats and Republicans use physical appearance as a source of, I guess you would call it, ridicule for people they don't like. And when I hear it, I think it makes everyone sound a bit more petty and realize that their arguments also come across a little less convincing. I mean, would you agree with that?
Very much so. In fact, you know, Kathleen Willis, the state representative, contacted me after the column ran, and she said she's had people ridicule her about her weight. And she said, you know, when that happens, she will just turn them off, and she doesn't listen to what they have to say about other things. And I think it's a pretty normal human reaction. It just doesn't accomplish anything when you do that. I mean, you need to talk in a civil manner to other people. It's okay to disagree on policy issues, but why bring somebody's appearance or weight or anything else into the mix? And, you know, I hear Democrats do the same thing with President Trump. I mean, and I'm not defending the president by any means, because I think he's done a lot to lower the level of civility in the United States. But when I hear James Carville joke about his weight or call him a big fat loser, it accomplishes nothing in the mix.
For those that haven't read the column, you mention in there that you've battled with your weight at times as well. You make that clear. So this hit home to you a little bit more.
Yeah, I used to weigh about 100 pounds more than I do today. I'm now at a healthy weight. I got there by eating less and exercising more, and I really find it discouraging when I hear people judge others by that sort of criteria, you know, and I've been there. I remember when I was a young reporter in the Quad Cities, you know, 30 years ago, I had a city editor who would just denigrate me because I was overweight, and he would do that with other people as well. And so I always said, you know, judge me by what kind of things I report, judge me by how well I write, judge me by the things that I do as an employee. Why on earth am I being judged because I'm overweight? And none of us would want to be treated that way by a boss. And we're these politicians' bosses. So we ought to hold ourselves to the same standard we would want to be judged by. We ought to evaluate J.B. Pritzker based on his policies, on how he presents himself as a governor, how hard he works, and not based on, well, I don't like that he's so overweight.
We're talking with Scott Reeder. He's a freelance journalist, and he's written a recent column that talked about criticism of Governor J.B. Pritzker's weight and whether or not that's fair. Well, Scott, when a politician enters the political arena, isn't everything fair game? I mean, I've heard that before from people that, you know, their past is certainly going to come up, and many of the other things, even little mistakes or slip-ups they may say at times when they don't mean something, but they're still going to be criticized for it. Isn't it fair game?
Well, I think when you go into politics, you have to expect that people will go after those things. But that doesn't mean that it's appropriate or right for people to do so. You know, that's just not an appropriate thing to be discussing. I mean, I don't think politicians' children, you know, especially minors, should be something that's discussed and held against them, you know, their behavior. I remember when Jim Thompson was governor, people made a big issue about how his young daughter behaved sometimes. And I thought, that's really an unfair thing to do. Same deal with Governor Christie. I mean, when I was a reporter overseeing state house reporters all over the United States, I had a person who worked for me in Trenton, New Jersey, who would refer to him as Governor Krispy Kreme. And every time he would do that in a staff meeting, I would just kind of cringe and want to say, do you realize how stupid and petty you sound when you say things like this? We need to move past criticizing people for those sort of things and look at who they are and what they're doing.
Yeah, Scott, you mentioned earlier that we wouldn't find it acceptable for somebody to criticize a person's religion or something else about a person necessarily, something they might not be able to control. And yet I think there's a lot of people who think if somebody is overweight, well, they could do something about it. In many cases, maybe they could. But that seems to be sort of the dividing line on this issue. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, and I don't think it's a fair thing to say. I mean, yeah. You know, like I said, I've lost 100 pounds. But, you know, I deal with that with a bit of humility because I know the recidivism rate in weight loss is very high. People gain it back, and it's a lifelong struggle. So to hold that against somebody just isn't quite right. We all have our struggles in life, and some things are very obvious. I know when I'm overweight, everybody sees it. Some things are happening behind the scenes that we don't know about. And I just don't think those are things that are appropriate to discuss in the public forum.
Now, you called this out in your column, but you mentioned that in the past you've been in situations where you didn't feel maybe comfortable enough, or maybe you didn't have enough standing to call somebody out when they were making those types of criticisms of people. What do you think the average person should do when they see that? Let's say see it online on a social media post.
Well, you know, one of the most obvious things to do is say, hey, this is not appropriate. Let's keep this about policy. Let's move away from talking about a person's appearance. Those types of remarks really are appropriate or funny, but people do it anyway.
That's Scott Reeder. He's a former State House reporter and freelance journalist. And if you'd like to read the column we've been talking about, we have a link at our website at statewideshow.com. Scott, it's always good to talk with you, and thanks for taking time.
Thank you.
A Western Illinois University professor is working to commemorate the 1919 Chicago race riot through art. Mariana Bacchiao has more.
During a trip to Germany, WIU professor Peter Cole says he was inspired by the country's open dialogue with its own genocidal history. He was especially struck by sidewalk plaques that enshrine the names of Holocaust victims. Cole says the Chicago Race Riot Commemoration Project aims to acknowledge the city's racist history while uplifting local artists.
We are working with a studio in Chicago that's created by the Firebird Arts Community Project, which is a nonprofit art studio that teaches young people who are Chicagoans who are themselves victims of violence in glass blowing and ceramics as a form of art therapy. And so we will have our markers created by people who themselves were victims of violence in the city of Chicago.
These local artists will create 38 pieces, one for each person who lost their life in the Chicago race riots of 1919. The glass work will be installed where each victim was killed. Artists will begin working on the project this winter, with the final pieces being finished sometime in the spring. I'm Mariana Bacchiao.
Raging California wildfires on one coast and the most active Atlantic hurricane season in history on the other are just two examples of how the climate is changing. It's also changing how the insurance industry prepares for increased risk of property damage, and in some cases, trying to prevent it. Eric Stock explains.
Max Rudolph is a financial consultant who studies risk management. He compiles an annual survey of emerging risks for insurance companies. For the first time last year, insurers named climate change their top concern. Rudolph says whether it's wildfires, hurricanes, or tornadoes, insurers see it in the data and see it with their own eyes.
Whether we're actuaries who are looking at data or whether it's somebody, you know, just trying to live their life, our lives are changing because climate change has triggered some additional events that we didn't grow up with.
Rudolph says Hurricane Harvey seemed to be a tipping point. The Gulf Coast storm in 2017 caused $125 billion in damages, the second costliest storm in history. Rudolph says the increased frequency of these once-in-a-lifetime events reminds him of the financial collapse over a decade ago. He says it became clear old projections no longer made sense.
You'd see people who were pricing these and trading on these risks, and they'd come back and say, well, we just had three 1-in-10,000-year events on consecutive days. And it's like, okay, well, that doesn't work. You know, if you have them on three consecutive days, that means your data's not telling you the right answer.
The insurance industry says it's better able to assess risk now. Dale Hall is managing director of research at the Society of Actuaries in Schaumburg. He points to another moment that shook the insurance industry, Hurricane Katrina. He says many insurance companies suffered big losses. They have since gotten much better at precisely identifying risk, not just down to the county or zip code, but down to each property.
That prompted much more the computer technology and very specific latitudes and longitudes now to be tracked on every property. I mean, we see that today, obviously, as we use Apple Maps or Google Maps, how finite you can get to where properties are located.
Insurance companies have been able to better assess risk through technology such as artificial intelligence. Sean Kevlin is CEO of the nonprofit Insurance Information Institute.
The industry's gone from being a one that detects and then recovers from catastrophe to now looking and trying to enable its customers to better predict and prevent those.
The Institute has produced what it calls a resilience accelerator. It analyzes large amounts of data to develop risk assessments. For example, the accelerator tracks hurricane paths over the last 100 years. The Institute plans to use that to develop risk scores for specific properties. He says just as smart home technology has helped homeowners detect things like water leaks, the technology could help assess areas where stronger building codes and more weatherproofing of homes may be needed. But Kevlin says the data also shows more people are living in riskier places than they used to. As a result, Kevlin says there's a growing insurance protection gap. Many people don't have enough insurance.
There's a lot of misperception that government will come in and help them recover. We work with the likes of big city emergency managers, even who every day have fires and such in their communities, and oftentimes find that, you know, in large apartment buildings and stuff, there's significant underinsurance.
Kevlin says many homeowners mistakenly think their homeowners insurance covers flooding. It does not. You have to buy that through the federal government. In McLean County, about 1 in 500 property owners has flood insurance. Some areas are just too risky for insurance companies. Many insurers, including State Farm, have pulled out of some higher-risk coastal properties. But financial consultant Max Rudolph says in many instances, the insurance industry and governments perpetuate the problem by allowing redevelopment in places that are likely to get devastated again. Rudolph calls for a more proactive approach to keep people off of high-risk land.
How is this going to look 50 years down the road, as opposed to this is my home, I don't want to lose my home, which I'm very sympathetic to that. But at the same time, if the same event is going to continue to happen, insurance has to be sustainable or it can't be offered.
Rudolph says he'd like to see more state and local government buying high-risk property. That's been done in Illinois as a form of floodplain management. As the natural disasters increase in intensity and frequency, Dale Hall with the Society of Actuaries says the industry is starting to move in that direction.
Those are the types of conversations, especially when it comes to California wildfires, that we're seeing happen already.
Hall says some insurers are also sharing some of the risk with consumers through higher deductibles for stronger storms that hit coastal properties. He says insurers, including State Farm and Country Financial, have diversified by offering more services, expanding their geographic footprint, and bolstering their own protection through reinsurance. And financial consultant Max Rudolph says climate change is not just a problem on the coasts. Illinois has seen gradual changes, too, including a modest increase in tornadoes. But Rudolph says, unfortunately, it often takes a disaster to get people's attention. I'm Eric Stock.
Both State Farm and Country Financial declined our request for an interview. State Farm did say in a statement the insurer has a high level of interest in climate change research, and it's focusing on how to better predict weather events and their impact. We have more of Statewide on the way, and remember, you can get our weekly podcast through the NPR One app. Just look for Statewide Show. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. A national organization called the Confess Project is seeking to help black men manage their mental health in a place many consider a second home, the barber shop. Jerome Hightower looks at how the Confess Project is working to train Chicago barbers.
Lorenzo Lewis founded the Confess Project in 2016. The issue was personal. He was diagnosed with depression in his 20s and then became a mental health worker himself.
And I understood that if we did not mobilize great listeners and advocates on the ground to help individuals and daily walks of life to get the help and to feel comfortable and feel received, that our country will continue to struggle.
In his training sessions, Lewis outlines the importance of active listening, validating clients' feelings, and reducing stigma. Darren Roca is the owner of Chicago barbershop Urbane Blades. He got interested in the Confess Project a few years back. He worked with Lewis to bring a training session to Chicago. The training is built on a close relationship between barber and client. For Darren, the barbershop is a sanctuary and a hangout.
It's a long joke, you know, it's the black man's country club, you know, that you don't have many places that you can go to and fellowship and communicate and just let your hair down, literally. You know, in this case, you're cutting it off.
Darren listens to people's life stories in 45-minute sessions every few weeks, kind of like a therapist, and he will see them for years.
I've cut numerous guys, you know, from the time they were about to go on their first date, and next thing you know, years later, some of them months later, you know, there's a wedding in talks.
Then there's the anniversary, or maybe the divorce.
Yeah, I got you.
On a busy early fall Saturday at the barbershop, client Roderick Walden talks with Darren about his haircut.
Mad low, you know, maybe higher on the top. Then, you know what I'm saying, just hella low.
As the COVID pandemic soared, especially in the black community, Roderick sought help from a professional counselor. The challenge was finding a therapist who was also a black man. He feels this identity connection is important.
So we have issues that are specific to us, you know, in terms of how we show up in the skin that we're in, that a person that's not in the skin that we're in will not be able to understand.
Despite a lack of therapists of color, Darren and the Confess Project were able to pull together a list to give out if people ask. Barbers also get trained to call 911 in case of a mental health emergency. But that could present a problem. Too often, it's the police who have to deal with the situation, better served by mental health professionals. Chicago psychologist Dr. Obari Cartman specializes in treating black men. His method builds on black culture, hip-hop, movement, art, and drumming. He says systemic disinvestment in black communities has had a negative impact on mental health, and 2020 has been especially hard.
So I'm seeing a lot of people that are really down this year, and I'm seeing a lot more addiction. I'm seeing a lot more thoughts of suicide, a lot more depression, and a lot more hopelessness.
According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, suicide is the third leading cause of death for black males under 20 and the fourth leading cause for black men between 20 and 44. The problems are deep and complicated, but there have been successes. Confess Project founder Lorenzo Lewis says one of their barbers helped prevent a client from taking his own life. Some of the conversations are very serious, some are not serious at all. And that goes to show in the barbershop, you can talk about almost anything. I'm Jarrell Hightower.
An Illinois State University student with a gift for words and a heart for equality has been nationally recognized for her poetry skills. Tiffany Jackson introduces us to the winner of this year's America's Best College Poet competition.
English education major Nadia Williams brought her best content to the stage as she battled it out with students across the country for a cash prize and bragging rights. Williams said as time led up to the award, she was doubtful and nervous.
There were three rounds. And every round, I always psych myself out because I'm like, oh, my God, I could have said that better. I could have protected my voice more. Oh, what if they don't like the poem? What if it's not as analytical as people are looking for?
But the feeling subsided soon after. When she was announced as the winner, tears fell from her eyes.
We get to the final round, and they were supposed to announce my scores before the final poet, but they didn't. And I'm just sitting here, I'm praying to God. I'm like, God, I don't know what's going on. I'm like, if I don't win, it's okay. And then, like, they announced to me that I won. All of the tears ran down my face. I had on makeup that day. I was crying so hard.
Here's Williams reciting from Black Boy Magic.
Black boy be a Darnell, Sean J, Deshaun, Dre, Quan, or TJ. Be unorthodox names, but never unethical. In heaven, black boys can be carefree, drinking Arizonas, eating Skittles, playing music too loud, wearing a hoodie.
Most of Williams' poetry resonates with the African-American community. She says of the reason she got into poetry is it allows her to express emotions that are often taboo.
For the majority of my life, I've always been told that little black girls should be quiet. Little black girls are meant to be seen and not heard. Because when you're an outspoken black woman, they always determine that you're angry or you're bitter or you're mean. And poetry allows me to be as black as I need be with no repercussions.
Williams said it's played a huge role in her confidence.
Poetry changes how I project my voice. In today's society, a black woman expressing herself is dangerous, it's lethal. And poetry allows me to get away with something that feels illegal.
As stereotypes grow as a consequence for challenges faced by members of the black community, some choose to withdraw from conversations. Williams said, growing up, it was words from black women that instilled a sense of hope in her, and that those same voices are needed for the new generation of black kids today.
If it wasn't for the words of my mother, if it wasn't for the words of Maya Angelou Chu, if it wasn't for the words of Beyonce, like, where would black women be without inspirational black women speaking into them? There is so much power in words coming from black women. And we see that every time Michelle Obama decides to share with us who she is being a black woman from the South Side of Chicago.
At one point, Williams almost quit poetry. After coming in third place in a competition brought by the National NAACP, she began to feel she wasn't good enough to continue on.
This time around, I was really giving up on myself in poetry because I felt like I was so on fire for poetry in the beginning, and it seemed like the fire began to fizzle out. So the day I won, it reaffirmed that this is something I was supposed to be doing, that my voice is something that needs to be consistently heard.
In the future, Williams says she hopes to make a difference in the way poetry is taught.
I want to focus on a live poet and poets of the last 2 or 3 decades. I want to change what poetry looks like to people. Because when people think of poetry, they think of Emily Dickinson, Robert Frost, like the canonized poet. So I mainly want to be a professor of my craft.
Williams says she's accomplished a lot within the craft, but there's plenty more milestones to go. I'm Tiffany Jackson.
Williams plans to graduate from ISU next year. She intends to get her master's degree in creative writing with a focus on poetry. She wants to become a poetry professor. Floor hockey, swimming, and volleyball are among the 18 sports offered by Special Olympics Illinois during normal times. But these, of course, are not normal times due to COVID-19. Even though much Special Olympics activity has been sidelined due to the pandemic, athletes are finding ways to keep active and engaged. Rich Egger tells us about one of them.
William Reynolds loves playing the drum kit set up in the living room of his home in Macomb. Drumming is not an Olympic sport, but William says it does help him prepare for sports.
It's exercise, and it helps me keep in shape, so.
The drumming does?
Yes. It's good exercise, and it makes me feel good, too.
Playing sports also makes him feel good. Basketball and softball are his favorites. William says he has always liked basketball, and he enjoys being the catcher in softball.
I get to throw the ball to the pitcher, and that's fun too. So, and then wearing the face guard shield when I'm behind home plate.
William stands more than 6 feet tall and looks like he could slug a softball a country mile. William is excited about the Special Olympics and says it's about more than competition.
To have things to do, to make friends. I'm in my happy place when I'm doing the Olympics a lot.
But it is at least a little bit about competition.
Try to win medals, too.
He's never been to the statewide Special Olympics. He hoped to do so this year, competing in his favorite sports and taking in festivities such as the opening ceremonies. This audio is from the 2019 opening ceremonies in Normal. There is no audio from the 2020 opening ceremonies because no festivities and no games took place due to the pandemic. For now, all Special Olympics team sports remain suspended, which means athletes are missing out on opportunities, and not just in terms of competition.
They have missed out on a lot of that socialization, and just like us, they need that to be able to stay healthy.
Julie Eggleston is program coordinator for the McDonough County Special Recreation Association. She says not only are the team games suspended, but it's been a challenge just to hold practices.
We utilize high school gyms, and the high school gyms are restricting any outside organizations coming in to utilize their gym space because of COVID-19.
Eggleston says the Special Olympics Illinois is doing what it can to keep athletes active. For example, virtual competitions are taking place. Athletes must train individually with coaches or family members, then submit scoring to the Special Olympics office. Even during this downtime for team sports, Eggleston is still urging athletes to get physicals. That way, they'll be ready to compete when the time comes.
We want everybody to be ready to rock and roll as soon as we can.
William Reynolds was ready to rock and roll this year, and he did, even though the in-person competitions were not held. The Special Olympics usually holds a torch run across the state in advance of each year's games. This year, they held a virtual torch run, and William took part by riding his bicycle for 2 miles.
Then I had to put my picture with my bicycle on the Special Olympics website, and then they sent me a shirt and a medal for doing that.
William enjoyed receiving the medal so much that he's trying a new sport in hope of earning more Olympic glory. For now, he's bowling as part of a social program through the Special Recreation Association. He knows he must work on his technique.
I have to look at the arrows and make sure it goes down there, straight down to get all the pins.
William hopes to improve enough to compete in the Special Olympics in bowling, as well as basketball, softball, and track and field. And he hopes to one day hear the roar of the crowd while competing in the Special Olympics, Illinois. But during a year when so much of normal life has been upended, William Reynolds is thankful for what he does have, his family and friends, the occasional activities, and his first Special Olympics medal. Rich Egger reporting.
It's been more than 3 months since Missouri's electronic monitoring law went into effect. That law allows families to set up cameras in nursing home residents' rooms. Illinois has had a similar law for about 5 years. But as Shayla Farzon reports, some families in Missouri have run into unexpected challenges when trying to install the cameras.
Willia Rakem used to visit her 73-year-old mom at Life Care Center of St. Louis about 3 times a week. She'd bring fried chicken for dinner, and they'd hug and chat. In March, when the pandemic forced the nursing home to shut its doors to visitors, Rakem stood outside so they could at least see each other. But she says her mom, who has dementia, was confused. She didn't understand why her family couldn't come inside.
We was like, oh, we wish she could, you know, hug you. Because she's like, you can't. You're just 2 feet away from me. Open the door. I'm like, oh, my God.
So when Rakem and her siblings heard about a new Missouri law that would allow them to install a camera in their mom's room, they jumped on it. The siblings pooled their money, about $250, and bought a Google tablet for her room. They hooked it up with no issues, and staff set it on her bedside table. But then a few days later,
all of a sudden, I could not get back on it. Like, I couldn't log back on.
Life Care Center staff had turned off the tablet. The facility's director told Rakem she needed to get written permission from her mother's roommate and fill out a form to be sent to the Missouri Department of Health and Senior Services. She did both, and for the past 2 months, she's been waiting, calling the facility again and again.
In the beginning, it was like, well, we have to check with our corporate office. Okay, well, we're still checking with our corporate office. Now we have to check with the state. And okay, now we got to get the paperwork. I mean, every stall after stall after stall. But it's just been frustrating.
Under the new state law, a facility cannot refuse a family's request to install a camera, says Chin Hung, program director for Voice, an organization that advocates for residents in long-term care. But he says there's no specific timeline for when they have to get it done. And that means families and staff have to cooperate with each other in order to get these devices installed.
This is actually a process of negotiation. If you don't compromise, then things probably will not get done until after COVID.
Many nursing homes are dealing with staff shortages, and at the same time, they're trying their best to keep the coronavirus at bay. And some, Hung says, are understandably wary about the possibility of visitors passing the virus to elderly residents.
Let's say if there is 20 households in this facility that want to get their camera installed, then we are talking about at least 20 visitors that come in. And that's actually very dangerous.
Facilities are not required to allow relatives inside to install the devices. But in some cases, in order to get things done, nursing home staff are taking on the task themselves. Marianne Schrader is the social services director at McKnight Place Extended Care. The St. Louis County Nursing Home is still closed to visitors, so Schrader installed a camera herself in a resident's room while his family stood outside the window and told her where to place it. Schrader says the cameras are just another way to communicate, but she adds that staff were a little uneasy at first.
I think we were all concerned of, you know, what is the intent? What is the purpose? But the family said right away, we just want to make sure our loved one is safe and see if we can help. And that's truly how it has been.
Advocates say ensuring the safety of nursing home residents and strengthening family relationships was always the goal of the legislation, which has been years in the making. Joanne Morrow of the Missouri Coalition for Quality Care says the pandemic pushed the issue to the forefront, but the reality is there are a lot of challenges to getting these cameras installed right now.
I think that
probably the electronic monitoring would not pick up until after, you know, we're able to get into nursing homes the way we used to be.
In St. Louis, Walia Rakem is still waiting for Life Care Center staff to put the camera she bought back in her mom's room. She believes staff there are taking good care of her mom, but she knows that her dementia is getting worse, that she's slipping away every day.
I just want to make sure she remembers us, you know. I don't want her to get lost. I'm just trying to do what I can so she's not lost.
Rakem doesn't know when she'll be able to hug her mom again. So for now, that camera is the only connection they have. I'm Shayla Farzan.
Stick around, we'll learn more about Prohibition in Southern Illinois and the violence it brought there. That's coming up on Statewide. We're back on Statewide. Remember to check our website for all our episodes at statewideshow.com. The Illinois State Bar Association is taking a new approach to address a shortage of attorneys in smaller communities. Its new Rural Practice Fellowship Program will offer $5,000 stipends to law students to spend the summer working in a smaller town. Recent law school grads can get up to $10,000 if they spend a whole year in a rural community. Dennis Orsi is president of the State Bar Association of Illinois' 102 counties. He says there are 13 with five or fewer practicing attorneys.
We really looked at it as an access to justice issue where we wanted to make sure there were going to be practicing attorneys throughout the state of Illinois that could provide legal services to the residents in those communities.
Applications for both tracks of the fellowship program are due by February 12th. Nearly a century ago, Prohibition led to the rise of Chicago gangs and figures like Al Capone and Bugs Moran. But if you would have ventured south to southern Illinois, you would have heard about the Shelton Gang and another led by Charlie Berger, just as violent as their Chicago counterparts. Berger was at war with the Sheltons, led by brothers Carl and Bernie, as each controlled profitable bootlegging, gambling, and other illegal activities. Shootouts were common, murders were planned and carried out. The Sheltons even rented an airplane, dropping a homemade bomb on Berger's headquarters. The wild era lasted only for a few years, but for decades, the exploits have been talked and written about, most famously in the book Bloody Williamson. Years later, the Saturday Evening Post ran a story on the Sheltons with the title America's Bloodiest Gang. Author Tara McClellan McAndrew has also put together an article on the Prohibition period in Southern Illinois, and she joined me to talk more about it, and we began by talking about why the Chicago gangs have gotten so much more notoriety.
I basically talked to former state historian Sam Wheeler about difference in publicity. What Sam said was the Capone syndicate in Chicago got more notoriety basically because they were feeding gin and liquor to a larger population. They were dealing with larger amounts of money. The Chicago folks got more publicity.
In Southern Illinois, we're talking about two main rivals, the Berger Gang, the Shelton Gang. Talk about them.
Yes, the Sheltons were born in Wayne County and were raised in a poor family. And according to the paper of one historian I read, the Sheltons, as well as Berger, were both raised in households where violence was a way of life and being tough was considered important to being a man. Berger was actually born in Russia. He was an immigrant here at a young age, and he kind of drifted around. He did all sorts of jobs, low-end jobs, until he finally settled in Southern Illinois. And both the Sheltons and Berger eventually found their way into illegal activities and kind of settled on bootlegging, but also branched out into prostitution and gambling.
The term lawlessness comes up a lot when we discuss this era. There were police, but they weren't necessarily able to quell this lawlessness that was taking place.
That's exactly right. And there are a variety of reasons for that. One is a lot of law enforcement, maybe not a lot, but definitely some law enforcement, some local officials, leaders of the towns in Southern Illinois were on the gangsters' payrolls. So they didn't really have that much incentive to stop either Burgers or the Sheltons' activities because they profited from them. Another reason that law enforcement couldn't always best the gangsters in Southern Illinois, it literally armed warfare, was because accounts say that the gangsters were better armed. The gangsters even had their own handmade armored vehicles. I saw a picture of one that the Chicago History Museum has, and it's just amazing. Think of an old 1920s era car that someone then takes these large sheets of metal and literally pounds them over the car, makes a teeny little hole for the driver to be able to see through, and you have a handmade armored car. And in fact, each gang, the rival gangs, the Sheltons, one day paraded their armored vehicles around a small town square. And then Burger's gang did it the next day in show of powers. So I highly doubt that the law enforcement, local law enforcement, had armored vehicles at that time to try to outmatch the power that the gangsters had. They were simply out-armed.
Without police coming in trying to tamp this down, that led to, I guess, what we would consider more vigilantism. That led to the rise there of the Ku Klux Klan. Can you talk about the KKK's role in Southern Illinois?
The KKK had what's called its second wave in the 1920s, and it wasn't just in Southern Illinois. It was all across America, and it was rising in prominence again because it was fighting what it considered lawlessness in a lot of areas and immorality that was brought on by the Roaring Twenties, and it rose in Southern Illinois quite a bit. Heron, in fact, had its own Klan newspaper, and a lot of local leaders, even ministers and law enforcement, were Klan members. Women were Klan members too. It was considered a very noble group that was fighting against criminals and immorality. And the KKK decided that bootleggers were absolutely one of their opponents because they promoted lawlessness. They helped the decline of family life because they provided alcohol, which created alcoholism and family violence, etc. So the KKK decided to fight the bootleggers down in Southern Illinois, and in doing so, proved that they were a bit lawless themselves. They lost some public opinion because they were so rough and lawless in their own raids. They engaged in gun battles with the bootleggers. There were people killed. They would raid people's houses who were suspected of having stills, and they would damage them. They would sometimes beat up the residents, etc. I interviewed Springfield author Taylor Pensnow, who grew up in Southern Illinois and remembers hearing lots of stories.
The KKK financed literally an armed force operating under its banner, the KKK banner. And they brought in to head the KKK army a former federal officer named S. Glenn Young. Now, he was a zealous enforcer of prohibition, and he had no hesitation in leading shootouts with the gangsters that terrorized and mesmerized towns in the lower part of the state. For example, once in Heron, Young actually led the KKK on an assault on a hospital in which bootleggers or their allies had taken refuge. Sometimes the KKK would literally occupy a town, putting one of its members in the mayor's chair, another would become the police chief, and they would put up guard posts on major highways going in and out of the towns. And you had to get permission to go in or leave the towns by KKK guards. Now, the same thing was true of the gangsters.
So the Klan fell out of favor to some because of their activities. But frankly, the bootleggers also, once again, it appears, just outarmed them and were more victorious in battles, literal battles, with the Klan as well. Sean, you grew up in Herron, and you know, you heard about these stories for all of your life. What did you hear when you were growing up about this era and the Sheltons and the Burkers?
It really permeates the history of the town. I don't think people talk about it a lot today, just in average gatherings, but it is something that people do remember. I think as kids, you grow up thinking nothing ever happened in my hometown, or it's pretty boring here. And you look, and when you read back at what did take place there, you realize a lot did happen there, even though it was well before my time.
I love talking about people who grew up down there to hear what they heard.
We're talking with the author Tara McClellan McAndrew, and she's written an article about prohibition in southern Illinois. So Tara, really at the root of this was money, because these gangs controlled a lot of vice that was taking place, including illegal alcohol sales, and they were bringing in quite a bit of money.
Absolutely. They were bringing in a ton of money, and they were using part of that to pay off local officials so that they could operate fairly freely. But when you compare the Southern Illinois bootleggers to the Chicago bootleggers and gangs, Capone's groups, the Chicago gangsters were dealing with much higher sums of money than the Southern Illinoisans. But the Southern Illinoisans were doing very well. And I must point out the duality of these guys, both Capone and the Shelton gang and Burger. They used some of their largesse, some of their income, to help locals. There are stories about Burger paying for their funerals, and Shelton's paying for funerals of families who couldn't afford it, for helping folks who were destitute, giving them money, bringing them groceries. Now, whether or not they did that as part of a basically plan to try to gain support locally for their operations or not, I think will never be known. But the fact remains, there were many people who saw them really as heroes, kind of Robin Hood figures, because they helped them out.
Charlie Burger met his end at the hangman's noose. He was implicated in helping set up the murder of a small town mayor in southern Illinois. He was hanged in 1928. What I thought is kind of interesting is how the Sheltons, you know, they could have stayed in that area, they could have faded to obscurity, but they sort of had a second life of their own.
They sure did. And they went back to what had been their hometown headquarters in East St. Louis. And they operated things from there for a while. Of course, when Prohibition ended and booze was legal again, the Sheltons had to find a new gig. So they took over illegal gambling in the area. And then Peoria came calling, because Peoria was what was known as a wide open town where all sorts of illegal activities proliferated fairly publicly. And they moved to Peoria and took over vice in Peoria and did pretty well for a short time until a reform mayor was elected. Author Gary DeNeil talks about their success in Peoria in his book, A Night of Another Sort, Prohibition Days and Charlie Burger.
The take was from slot machines and jukeboxes, from a cut in the nightly hall of casinos in downtown Peoria, and from local officials up and down the state, who profited from such activities. Carl, careful to keep the circle complete, doled out a percentage of the profit to other, more powerful officials in Springfield. It was a well-oiled operation, one worthy of the attention of big city gangsters.
And thanks to Blanket Fort Radio Theater at SIU Press for the audio version of that book.
A side note to the Burger story that I think is not very well known and is of special interest to folks in Springfield is that it sounds like Springfield might have been the home of Charlie Burger if we hadn't been such a rough town.
So, Tara, we're talking almost 100 years since this gang warfare was taking place in southern Illinois. What evidence still exists down there of that time?
Well, great question, because in Benton, there's actually a museum that was the former jail where Burger spent his last days and was hanged. It is called the Franklin County Historic Jail Museum. And it's kind of an amalgam of the area's history. George Harrison visited his sister who lived there before he became a famous Beatle. They have information about that. They have information about actor John Malkovich, who grew up in the area. But you can, back to the Burgers and the Sheltons, you can see the jail cell where Charlie Berger spent his last living days and a reconstruction of the gallows there where he was hanged.
That's author Tara McClellan McAndrew. She wrote an article on Prohibition-era gang activity in Southern Illinois. A link is at our website. You can find that at statewideshow.com. And that's all the time we have for our final show of the year. We hope everyone has a better 2021. We'll be back next time. We'll have more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. And a reminder, our podcast can be found through the NPR One app, and you can find links to the stories you hear each week at our website. Once again, that's statewideshow.com. I'm Sean Crawford, and Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois, with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.